Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, CMS may be pushing another superintendent out the door. A decision on the future of Clayton Wilcox could come today. It could come this hour. Battle lines in the 2020 presidential election became clearer this week as Donald Trump's tweets remarks deemed to be racist, uniting Democrats on one side and Republicans on the other. Major League Soccer, here's Charlotte's latest pitch. Political gerrymandering goes to court again. News on the I-77. Toll lanes and the Southeast may bear the brunt of climate change. Our roundtable of reporters is set to detail those and other stories, and those reporters include David Borax from WFAE News. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Daniel Shemtob is a development reporter with the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back.
Good morning, Mike.
Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and a contributor to WCCB News Rising. Hello.
Good morning. Slow news week, eh?
Yeah. We don't have time to do the show. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Hello to you.
Hello, Mike.
And we're all on the radio. You can also watch us on Facebook Live. 6 months ago, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board gave Superintendent Clayton Wilcox a raise and a two-year extension on his contract.
I hope that it sends a clear signal to our community that we are on a path together as a leadership team.
Well, that was Wilcox then, but on Monday morning of this week, members of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board met with Superintendent Wilcox and decided to suspend him with pay. No one is talking about what led to the suspension, not Wilcox, not the school board chair, Mary McCray. Some believe it is tied to his failure to execute the fingerprinting policy for new hires. Is that still the speculation on what's going on here? Or do we have any new news about what might be going on here?
I was going to say, I think that's still the speculation that many of us are clinging to simply because nothing else has come out.
Because this is a personnel matter, no one's talking about it, but the board is meeting in 22 minutes this morning at 9:30 to talk about the future of Superintendent Wilcox. Is he in that meeting, or is it just the board meeting privately behind closed doors?
It's a good question. The meeting ostensibly is to discuss his contract. I suppose at some point you want to bring somebody in to confront them with anything you have.
If you're discussing somebody's contract, you're discussing how to get out of it, I would think, right?
They will be talking, I'm sure, with their lawyers. And they already on Monday morning, they talked with him, and the news came out after that meeting. So
this is behind the scenes because it's a personnel matter, but it is my understanding that if they decide to let him go, they must go into open session. Is that correct?
They have to take the vote, yeah.
In open session. If they choose to let him stay, will we know what this was all about? If they choose to let him go, will we know what this is all about?
I would say if they let him go, we will know sooner what this was all about.
Will they volunteer that information, or will we have to dig for it?
Well, if you remember when they fired Heath Morrison, yes, just a few short years ago, and I just want to remind everybody that if we get a new superintendent, it'll be the third one since 2014, like the fifth one.
Right. In 10 years.
Yeah,
in 10
years. 5 in 10 years.
But when they got rid of Heath Morrison, there was a report that was compiled leading up to his firing, and that information was leaked. Not quite sure how it got out, but it did come out that his management style was an issue and some other things. There may very well be a similar report to this. They maybe have been compiling this if this is coming to a head now. The question is whether we will get it or not.
But Mike, remember, I'm sorry, go ahead, Mike.
No, it's all right, go ahead.
I was just going to say, remember Mary McCray, who was also the head of the board then?
Yep.
It was originally positioned that Heath Morrison was leaving because of the illness
of his grandmother.
Of his grandmother, right? Yeah. And so once we figured out that the homework was not lost.
Well, these guys are always the best thing since sliced bread until they're not. And it usually happens instantly. It's like you buy a loaf of bread, you open it, take a slice out, you close it up. The next day you come back and you open it, it's full of mold. And that's what's happening here. And it seems to be not only a surprise to the community, but a surprise to the superintendent. It's like they don't provide any guidance whatsoever until you're done.
Yeah, I liken it to football coaches. It's the same thing as a loaf of bread. You know, the first 2 weeks, everything's great. In bread, it's a little shorter. And then all of a sudden, hey, get out. Why did I ever hire you? Why did I ever pay you? Kind of thing. And certainly in this community, it's been even more wrenching, I think, than in some others, because we've had all kinds of interesting extenuating circumstances.
And they're always, you know, they do the extensive personnel searches, you know, national searches. Mm-hmm. And so, and those take months and months. And then, when it happens, I think the lack of transparency is a big part of the story. Because even though, of course, it's personnel matter and you do it behind closed doors, you know, they're the largest employer in the city. You know, taxpayer money is involved. And even if you don't have a child in the system, you are really aware and interested in the reputation of the school system. And what does this mean? Every time it happens, will it make it more difficult for Charlotte to get high-quality personnel to come here if they feel that there's a certain amount of dysfunction involved?
There was a West Side community meeting this week that Clayton Wilcox was supposed to participate in and didn't because of his suspension with pay. But there were other people from the school system there, and organizers of that meeting said that the leadership turmoil causes a lot of anxiety. So here is School Board Chair Mary McCrae's response to that.
We know that this news can cause concern, and that is why I want to reassure our students, their families, our staff members, and the community that our work together for our students is continuing uninterrupted.
Was anybody comforted by those words?
You know, it's been interesting to see some of the reports with, you've heard teachers say that as soon as you start down one track, a new superintendent comes in and you have to start all over. You've heard other teachers who have said, just kind of, we go to work, we do what we do, and whoever's running it, so be it. So I think the opinion's all over the place. But in terms of public perception, Mike, clearly no one is comforted by that. I think most people are very upset that we are, as a community, right back in this circumstance again.
It is my impression, correct me if you know something other than this, he seems to be popular with the teachers.
Seems to be. Now, look, Andos Helms and Gwendolyn Glenn and right. Legions of others who cover education day to day could say it better than I could, but just on the surface, absolutely. And Mike, I wanted to add, while we're going through some of this in terms of the import, it's 150,000 students that are part of this system. It's a $1.5 billion annual budget. It's 19,000 employees. It's 175 schools. This has ripple effects for everyone, no matter whether you have kids in school or not.
Back to the previous point, I'm not sure that anybody saw this coming other than people on the school board. I mean, as you say, the teachers seem to like him. Many of them do. As far as parents go, there haven't been any major conflicts between the superintendent and parents. He seems to be attempting to respond to many of the concerns in the system. And so, you know, when I came into the office on Monday and Ann Doss Helms was in there early and said there's breaking news about the superintendent, it was a surprise to a lot of people.
There have been problems along the way with certain things, including the aftermath of the Butler High School situation, where the response to parents about what was going on there was a little slow. But this had probably never happened before, and at least on his watch. And he owned up to it. He said, we made mistakes.
And I guess there was the concern about the lead in the water,
right.
That the report was not delivered to parents fast enough. Yeah. But
and he got off to a little bit of a shaky start when he brought some folks in from Maryland and gave them those jobs. But since then, teachers have said he supported their pay raises. He wanted to give them more resources. And a lot of folks who were concerned about equity in the schools have said that he is trying to make some real strides in making sure that advanced placement tests and courses are in high and low income schools and that they're bringing more equity in the schools. And so, you know, it's like anything else. There's some problems he's had, but he has some support as well.
Eric. Mike, I was just going to say, you know, when you go back to Peter Gorman, for example, who was another very high profile, perhaps even higher profile superintendent, much lauded. It was not a surprise when he left. I mean, there were things that happened with the closing of the schools, particularly in the African-American neighborhoods and communities. You could see how there might be a parting of the ways. With this one, there really hasn't been. I mean, yes, all those things are valid, but they haven't been searing community-type issues.
Yvette Townsend Ingram was one of the organizers of that community meeting on the West Side this week, and she told WFAE that the community will be watching the school board's next steps.
You can't have trust in an organization with that much chaos and instability. They have done a great job. CMS school board has so far. Looking forward to working with them still. We do have a great relationship with them, but now is the time for them to show in difficult times what CMS is really all about.
And that is the key, is it not? I mean, the average tenure of a school board of a school superintendent is about 3 to 5 years. He just entered his third, I believe. He just signed that contract in January for a 2-year extension. And if he is dismissed, as you have said, Mary, well, this will be the
fifth in ten years.
What does that say about the board and about leadership and about how this board or these boards that we've had over the years understand the relationship between a board and a superintendent and what the superintendent is supposed to do?
You know, I think it says it's a really tough job, and maybe some of the ex-superintendents would say it's an impossible job to meet the requirements of the board and hold on to your job. I mean, think of what we want the superintendent to do. We want equity. We want fairness across the system. We want higher pay for teachers. We want schools in our neighborhoods. You know, there are so many different things that we demand out of the school system. It's a lot for one person to have on their shoulders.
So going back to the beginning of this, Heath Morrison disappeared overnight. He was the greatest thing since Santa Claus, and then he disappeared overnight. And then we had the interim, Ann Clark, who had been with the system for a long, long time. I think she spent her entire career with CMS, first as a teacher, and had worked under other superintendents. And she made a logical choice. She delayed her retirement to stay for a couple of years while they did a search. They did this search, and they hired Clayton Wilcox quickly and relatively secretly. He wasn't there for the board meeting where they named him. I don't think he had did any public appearances when he was here to interview. We know that he had some rocky relationships with previous school boards in Pinellas County, Florida, and to a certain degree up in Hagerstown, Maryland, which is where he came from directly before he came here. Still, and there's been some friction between this board and Clayton Wilcox, still Ross Danis, the head of the group that was involved in the search that led to his hiring, MEC Ed, said this suspension seemed to come out of the blue.
You know, you talk about a person who is what he is. He's you know, the same person morning, noon, and night. He listens. He does care. He does support teachers. I've actually never ran into anyone. We come in contact with hundreds of parents, teachers, civic leaders. And I have to say, I've never heard or even picked up on anything.
Of course, we don't know what this is all about, in fairness to the board and in fairness to people making these decisions, but what message does this send to people in education circles around the country about Charlotte Mecklenburg schools?
Well, I think so much depends on what's going to happen in however many, 12 minutes and forward. But assuming that it's similar to what we're hearing so far, I think it goes back to a little of what David was saying. This is so much pressure in one job and a school board demanding so much, apparently, in some of these circumstances. I'm sure people are going to look twice, if for no other reason. You're talking about 5 people in the job in 10 years, Mike. I mean, you naturally would look at that and say, well, wait a minute, what's going on?
There's also overarching issues that will not disappear no matter what happens. You'll always have this achievement gap that the superintendent will, you know, be tasked with trying to close. You'll have bond issues that you'll need the community support if they want to support the schools. And in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area, you have the suburban districts, you know, Mint Hill, Matthews, Cornelius, Huntersville, that are looking and saying, well, maybe we need to split off and do our own thing. So that's another stress of someone trying to keep such a large system together.
We have 30 seconds in this segment, but if you were a candidate, if you're a person on a superintendent track, is this a job you would apply for? Given if he's dismissed, would you apply for this job?
You know, it's a great question. Whether, I mean, they had candidates in the past. They will probably get candidates again. There's always going to be somebody who wants to move to a bigger district.
They'll have a real ironclad contract, though, let me tell you.
Yeah, somebody who wants to earn $400,000 a year. Who would that be? Oh, I'll apply now. All right, it's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup with David Borax here from WFAE News, Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal, Mary C. Curtis, Roll Call on WCCB-TV, and Daniel Shemtob from the Charlotte Observer, where she is a development reporter. We'll talk about some development news here in a moment or two. But right now we're talking about the school board because in 8 minutes the school board is to convene in private session to discuss what's going on with the superintendent who was put on paid suspension this week on Monday morning for reasons we do not yet know. We do know that Clayton Wilcox's original contract, he had a 2-year contract which was renewed in January. His original contract required the district to pay his base salary, which is considerable, for 2 years if he is fired without the board listing specific reasons. Do we know if that would be true of his contract extension, the one they gave him in January? Do we know if that provision only governs whether they tell him the reasons for his firing or they have to divulge those reasons to us?
You know, it would be standard in any contract like this that they can fire him for cause and not have to pay his salary. Do they have to tell anybody why that is? I think they will have to say something. And
because, you know, cause in this case is dishonesty, neglect of job duties, fraud, theft, or violation of board policies and decisions.
That's from the contract.
Right.
Yeah. And we don't know which, if any, of those might be under discussion right now.
You know, Mike, going back to you played that clip from the gentleman from MECED talking about how this came out of the blue. The other aspect of that, you know, it was just over the weekend that Clayton Wilcox had compiled essentially a rundown of his achievements in the school system's achievements that he posted on social media, the billion-dollar bond.
Did he do that just before or just after?
Just before.
Saturday night, I believe.
Yeah. He knew it was coming.
Yeah.
That account is up.
But they met him on Mary McCray met with him on Friday of last week. So that account has been taken down.
Yes.
That's what Ann Doss Helms tells
us, yeah. But, just interesting how all of this is playing out as we were talking off the air about the public relations. For, you know, you can see all the pieces in motion here.
So if they let him go, even if they let him stay, does the school board have a moral obligation to him and to parents and to teachers and to just general citizens to tell us what this is all about?
I think, going back to what David said, they're going to have to say something. How granular it gets, I don't know the answer to that. I would think they would take probably a higher level in terms of the explanation, but I don't think you can have a superintendent leave after 2 years and just say nothing.
And 6 months after them giving him a contract extension and a raise.
Right. You can't say he got a $30,000 raise 6 months ago and now we've decided he's unfit to run our system. See ya.
So
there's
board,
no way they can do that.
The board meets in 5 minutes. They're scheduled to meet this morning in private at 9:30. If they fire him, they have to do it in public session. And I understand that may not come today because they have to give 48 hours notice of a public meeting. Is that correct?
They do.
So it would have to be Monday or Tuesday.
Well, they're meeting today, right?
That's correct. I mean, public session. They have to fire him in public session.
I'm not sure how they noticed this meeting. It's possible they could come out of
that. Yeah, that's what I was trying to remember. Did this meeting have
parameters?
So the school board has spent $30,000 to hire a global public relations firm that specializes in crisis management to deal with the aftermath of the suspension. The firm is Ketchum. They worked for Penn State in the aftermath of the Jerry Sandusky sexual abuse scandal and with Malaysia Airlines after one of their planes simply disappeared from the skies 5 years ago. Those were major, major incidents. If this were in that category, would they get away with paying them $30,000?
That was the first thing I thought, too. I mean, yes, it is notable that they've hired this national PR firm that has been involved in obviously some really high-profile controversies, but $30,000 is not a lot in the public relations world.
My thought about that is it's a short-term contract,
yeah,
you know, 1 or 2 weeks.
That's what it feels like, yeah.
I mean, it may be that they want some help if there is an announcement to be made in crafting that carefully so that they convey what happened without telling us what happened.
Well, perhaps they need to hire a different public relations firm to do the PR on why they hired this high-profile firm if the situation doesn't really warrant it.
Well, I mean, to me, the announcement that they had hired Ketchum really raised some new questions. Like, is there something else here that we don't know about that is so bad that they need one of these big firms to handle it?
Also people saying, if you're going to spend $30,000 to do this, why don't you just be a little bit more transparent and honest, and instead of hiring this crisis, what is the crisis, as you say, David? What are we not hearing?
In the meantime, the system has appointed Ernest Winston, the district's chief of community engagement and its ombudsman, to be the acting superintendent.
I feel extremely encouraged. I've had a number of community members, staff members, parents reach out to me to express their support, and so I feel very much supported.
So who is he? Who is Ernest Winston?
Well, he used to be a journalist. He worked,
at the Observer. That's right.
So you know he's a journalist. He's a person of sterling character.
He used to be.
Who says there's media bias? Absolutely not.
He used to be a former teacher at Vance High School. How does all of this so he's been with the system for a while, so he's not a stranger. But how does all of this impact CMS as they get ready to go back to school next month?
Well, I mean, this is obviously terrible timing. You're 6 weeks away from starting school, and the clip we played earlier of Mary McCrae was an attempt to reassure people, as everyone has going back to school in their minds, that things are intact. I did want to mention about Ernest Winston, and I think maybe Andos Helms reported this or re-reported this, that there was controversy over his salary, $175,000 a year, and the fact that his job was not posted publicly, and also there was consternation about the fact that he reports directly to the superintendent rather than to the school board. So if he has this job going forward for any amount of time, those questions are likely to pop up again.
I was going to also mention that he has been an aide to the last couple of superintendents, and I believe one of his titles has been ombudsman. So he's been there in the superintendent's office for a while. It may be that he's a caretaker until they sort this out.
Yeah.
It may be, there's still that possibility that Clayton Wilcox will be back and that everything will go back to hunky-dory.
Yeah.
He has a lot to do, too. There's some high-profile schools that need principals right now.
Otherwise, we have to spend $100,000 on a search committee to find a new superintendent again.
Including West Charlotte.
West Charlotte, That's where he was at the meeting. They're very concerned. There are other schools, and so parents and teachers and everyone wants to know what's up.
And there's also an assistant superintendent search underway, and school starts in just, 5 or 6 weeks right now.
That meeting that they've scheduled, the private meeting the school board has scheduled, just started if they're on broadcast time, which they're probably not. They're probably having pastries right now. But I'm told by one of our producers that the notice of that meeting was 48 hours ago, and that allows them to go to open session today.
It could come out of closed session.
So meanwhile, let's move on to other turmoil. Donald Trump has been churning things with his tweets this last weekend about the women he must see as the four congresswomen of the apocalypse. Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar, I hope I say their names correctly, of Minnesota, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts, and Rashida Tlaib, of Michigan, in which he suggested if they aren't happy here, as demonstrated by some of their criticisms, that they should go back where they came from and fix the problems here or there and then come back here. They, along with a united Democratic Party, called those tweets racist. Republicans, with only a few exceptions, were either quiet or denied the racist intent of those tweets, and that includes North Carolina's junior Senator Tom Tillis.
The president's not a racist. He's not a xenophobe. He's the son of an immigrant. He's the husband of an immigrant. And people are trying to mischaracterize him. I don't believe he's a racist. I don't think there was a racist intent in the communications this week either.
Charlotte Representative Alma Adams, who is black, issued a statement in which she said, quote, "It's been more than 24 hours since the president's hateful, un-American tweets, and there has been no apology. Instead, the president has doubled down on his dangerous rhetoric, proving that he is a racist who is unfit to serve." This is splitting, as one might imagine, down party lines. However, the Raleigh News and Observer emailed questions about Trump's tweets to North Carolina Republican Mark Meadows, to Senator Richard Burr, to Representatives George Holding, Virginia Fox, David Rauser, Richard Hudson, Patrick McHenry, and Ted Budd, all Republicans, and none replied. What are we to take from that?
Well, we are to take that, they realize that they could be hurt electorally if they cross Donald Trump, President Trump. And so they're trying to keep quiet about it. There's also been a lot of false equivalency saying, well, you know, as Mitch McConnell said, the rhetoric is just getting way too heated on both sides. But as far as whether it's racist or not, according to the federal government, it is. Because you could get fired or sued if you worked for the U.S. government and they say you have something that is racist. And in the handbook it says, an example is if you say, go back to your own whatever, to the person. So if he was not president of the United States, he basically could be fired for saying those things.
There have been a few Republicans who have spoken out, but it seems to be emerging, much like Tom Tillis said, that if you're going to talk about this, you can condemn what he said, but you got to add that line, he's not racist. This morning on NPR, Republican Tom Cole from Oklahoma, from the House of Representatives, said Trump's tweets were inappropriate and offensive, but he's not a racist. So we're hearing that over and over, but he's not a racist.
We keep being told that there's not a racist bone in his body. I asked the mayor this question this week. I'm going to ask you. If you make a racist statement, can you not be a racist?
Well, I just think that right now it's kind of interesting. It's been turned around. To be called a racist or to say something is racist has become more taboo than to actually have an act of racism. And people say, what is this person in their heart? What do you know? You have to go by what the person does, what the person says. And basically, when it comes to Donald Trump, whatever you think of him, he has a history going back to the birtherism and such a long list of things that have shown that...
And his rental practices.
Yeah, of course. He started in New York.
Central Park 5.
Yeah, at Central Park 5. In New York, he and his dad were sued by the Nixon Justice Department, not exactly a bastion of liberalism, twice for discriminating against black folks in their housing. He started out his campaign saying that Mexicans are rapists. He said a Mexican-American judge could not be fair.
From Michigan.
Yes.
Born and raised.
Yeah, well, and also when he talks about if you criticize the country, you have to go back. Well,
he criticized the country when he was running for president.
Well, he talked about American carnage. It wasn't hope and change or Reagan's shining city upon
the
hill.
Why is it okay for Donald Trump to criticize the country 2 years ago, 3 years ago when he was running for president?
Well,
and it's not okay for these representatives to criticize.
Mike, not just as a candidate. Remember, he stood on a stage in international territory next to the Russian president.
Right.
And took his credibility over that of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which is the ultimate act of questioning. I was going to say, when we're talking about some of these Carolinas senators, I thought it was interesting and representative of what the Republican response has been. When Tom Tillis told Fox News that the chanting and the response of the crowd was uncontrollable because a crowd is just going to say what it says.
We're going to get back to that in a second here. We have a split in senatorial opinion in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. We have Senator Tim Scott, who's African American. He called Trump's words racially offensive. Lindsey Graham, here's a big surprise, backs Trump and called the four congresswomen a bunch of communists. He added, they hate Israel. They hate our own country. That last part is right out of the Richard Nixon Spiro Agnew playbook and their references to those who opposed Vietnam and government policy back then in the 1960s.
And the communism slur goes even further back.
Exactly right.
McCarthyism.
So I ask again, why is it okay for certain people to be critical of the government and government policies and what happens as a result of those policies and the state of the country in light of those policies, but it is not okay for others to say those same things? Why is that?
Well, I think it's pretty simple. It's either you're on my team or you're not. I mean, there's nothing complex going on here. You're either with us or against us.
And also, it's race as well.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, obviously, I'm a black person. I'm on the panel. I write columns. I've gotten innumerable responses saying, go back to Africa, where it's like, go back home. You mean Baltimore?
And so, Mary, we can't ignore the fact that this is really all about presidential politics and the election that's coming up.
Oh, a strategy, 2020.
And at that rally in Greenville the other night when those people were chanting, send her home about Omar, you know, I think Trump has found his slogan for the 2020 election.
Maybe or maybe not, because he's taken, he kind of prevaricated yesterday, and he said that he didn't back those people, and he said I shut them down by talking very quickly.
Let's go to the tape.
He waited 13 seconds. Let's go to the tape.
Ignorance is pervasive in many parts of this country. And obviously and importantly, Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
It goes on. We didn't play the full 13 seconds. We don't have time in this program to do that. So
let's add a quick visual here. He's nodding a little bit,
yeah.
And he's all, and I saw a smirk on his face.
And afterwards, he went back to the attack.
Yeah.
You know, let's face this. And you can see it's 2020 strategy. He's doubling down. He's always really governed his base, and he wants to turn out the base. He also wants to make these four congresswomen the face of the Democratic Party
the party. If we're here in the summer of 2019, where will we be in the summer of 2020?
God knows the way the news cycle and this thing works. I thought it was interesting, Mike, tying this together. Joe Bruno, who's obviously a frequent panelist on this program from WSOC, had the tweet yesterday that he had asked for comment from the RNC 2020 on the president's reactions and remarks regarding all of this with the squad, as they call these four congresswomen, and they had no comment. So that's really interesting, because all this is coming to a head, as you say, in Charlotte next
summer. This has been heavily covered in the news media, this North Carolina rally, and that's the reason we're talking about it, because it took place here. And part of the coverage has been people talking, reporters talking to some of the people who were at the rally and what their impressions were about both the chant and some of the president's remarks, and they do not see it as racist. And some of these people they look and sound to me like ordinary, intelligent, thoughtful individuals. How do we have such a divide where some people are calling this bald racism and others say, no, that's not what this is at all?
Well, there's always been divisions in America. He didn't create it. He's more a symptom than a cause. And, you know, this, so many other countries, it's all about the blood and the soil. America has been about when you come here, no matter where you come from, and you become a citizen, you're American. And that's difficult. But he does put that salt in the wound to create that wedge, to bring it out, to bring out these resentments. And it's kind of interesting the way North Carolina always seems to be in the middle of these things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the county he appeared in, he didn't win that county. And it's a third black. And, you know, it's much more complicated. So 2020.
And we stop there. Mary Charlotte. C. Curtis at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. WFAE Charlotte Talks is hosting a public conversation to explore what can be done about the city's rising number of homicides. Only halfway through the year, Charlotte has already surpassed 2018's total. CMPD says this problem can't be law enforcement's alone to address, and they need your help. We examine the factors behind our homicide problem and what community leaders are doing to find solutions. Join us Tuesday, July 30th at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church at 7:30 for this important conversation. More at WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. David Borax is here from WFAE News. Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call on WCCB-TV. And Daniel Shemtob with the Charlotte Observer. Before we move on to other things, because there are other things in the news, something seemed to happen with this story about these tweets and about the rally that followed those tweets. First of all, that rally was supposed to be a diversion from the Robert Mueller testimony, which was supposed to have taken place in Congress yesterday and was then postponed until next Wednesday. I don't know what he's going to do next Wednesday night when the actual testimony takes place, if it takes place.
Come back to North Carolina.
But something seemed to happen with the coverage of this. The media stopped using modifiers. The media did not say that these tweets, some would say, that these tweets were racist. They simply called them racist. Has the switch been thrown?
Well, I think part of what's going on here is, as journalists, we have to look at these things on a factual basis. And Mary just explained, for example, the federal guidelines for avoiding racist language or saying things that would get you fired. Look, these were racist remarks. There is no way around it. So maybe a switch has been thrown in terms of people no longer hesitating to say exactly what is in front of them. And in this case, these were racist tweets.
And the go back to
why is, Weber, I'm sorry, but why is the switch? What was it about this incident or this point in time that people at the editorial stages of NPR and the New York Times and the Washington Post decided not to couch this in pretty language?
Well, one, I think the go back to wherever trope is just documented that this is a racist trope that has been used for so many years. So it's not something he dreamed up. This is, as Eric said, factual. Also, he has this history of saying these things. So it's not I misspoke or anything like that. And also a realization, when you say something like it was a racially tinged comment, that was like, what, did they sprinkle racist fairy dust over this comment? These are just, it's history, and we have to deal in the facts. Then again, you've seen folks like the Fox Media critics saying that he disagrees with that. So there still is disagreement.
But I think what you're getting at, Mike, is that there is frustration and conversation within newsrooms and within media about how some of the past instances of rhetoric have been characterized, that racially tinged pixie dust you're talking about. I think a lot of the national media outlets in particular have decided, look, this needs to be described accurately as what it is and not sort of beat around
the bush.
Will
this carry over into other aspects of this presidency?
Well, it's interesting because you have heard before people have said he says things that are not true, or there's been a real hesitation to say a lie.
Right.
I was going to say at the beginning of his presidency, that was the debate in newsrooms.
Yeah.
When he would say something that was not true, we hedged around it. Untruths, saying things that are false. Finally, some of the large news outlets decided to adopt the word lie. He's telling lies. And
right.
And that's a judgment in the same way that the word racist is a judgment. But we've been drawn into this by him. And I think in some ways we are taking the bait. But it's really hard to sit there and not acknowledge what this thing is.
And you see them putting out evidence. This morning I saw it when he said, I tried to stop them. And the news report actually put up a timer on the screen
right.
of at click, 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 how long he let it go, and then what the aftermath was. So it's, you know, the news organization saying, we're going to do this, and now we're going to show you why we have judged this way.
We have breaking news. This just in, the CMS meeting has begun. There will be discussing, according to the school board, they are discussing a separation agreement. And Clayton Wilcox's chair at the dais is empty. So that's what they're doing right now. If anything else happens, we will let you know as we go through the program. South Carolina's former Governor Mark Sanford is considering a challenge to Donald Trump's presidency. Fellow Republicans in the state are stone cold on this idea. Why is he considering a run?
Well, the reason he gave is actually consistent with much of his political career, which is the debt and deficit. Remember way back in 2010, 2011, when the Tea Party and Republicans in general were talking so much about debt and deficit and had for decades before, I would say, but clearly have not since Trump has become president. And so he says that he feels like he has to do something to make that a central part of the conversation within the party again.
And yet they have history. When he criticized Mark Sanford, when Mark Sanford criticized the president mildly, I would say, and he tweeted actually support for his opponent in the primary.
Well,
Sanford lost.
Here's something interesting that's also going on within the Republicans' sphere. Sanford told the Charleston Post and Courier that I'm a Republican. I think the Republican Party has lost its way on debt, spending, and financial matters. This in the same month that conservative talk show host Rush Limbaugh announced that, quote, fiscal conservatism was a sham all along. He was responding to a caller who was critical of Trump for not being a fiscal conservative when he said nobody is a fiscal conservative anymore. All this talk about concern for the deficit and the budget has been bogus for as long as it's been around.
You know, Mike,
that's a pretty good Limbaugh.
I think this goes to a really big picture question about who are Republican voters. And right now, the the Republican Party has swung in, toward Donald Trump, and they are buying the idea that a Republican voter is someone who supports him and his ideas. But there are other ideas out there, like Mark Sanford is talking about, and like Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, who was also running and challenging Trump. You know, he wants to run because he thinks that Donald Trump thinks American citizens are his enemies, and that's not true.
Mike, if I may be permitted a blatant plug, next Thursday on this program, we'll be speaking with Tim Alberta, who has written a book called American Carnage, which is entirely about these issues we're talking about, which is the schism within the Republican Party.
What a shameful plug.
Well, do people remember when Reagan...
Learn from the master, sorry.
When Reagan, who Republicans look at as a patron saint, when he left, he talked about the joys and the Americanness of immigration on his way out. So the party has become, obviously, the party of Donald Trump.
Right.
And so, I mean, you know, look at the tax cuts. One of the few things, really, that they've accomplished, the Republicans, that really killed the deficit.
Just weeks after the U.S. Supreme Court in a case involving political gerrymandering in North Carolina's congressional district said that the courts had no business essentially being in the middle of it, a lower court is now hearing a case involving political gerrymandering in North Carolina's legislative districts. Why didn't the high court's decision just end that?
Well, because you have the difference between the congressional seats and the state legislature.
But the court said they had no business interfering in political gerrymandering, which this is. So if you can't do it at the congressional level, you can't do it.
Well, there's a difference between the federal level and the state level, and the state constitution is different from the federal constitution.
But this is a federal court.
This is a state court.
It is?
State court.
A state court. A three-judge panel is considering whether there was political gerrymandering in state legislative districts, which the Republicans have redrawn to favor them in recent years. And the arguments are very similar, but the outcome could be different for two reasons. One is the Constitution is different. And number two, the makeup of the North Carolina Supreme Court is different from what the federal court is.
But obviously you're going to hear some of those same arguments, and particularly because this guy that did the studies, Hoffeller, the Republican operative, was from North Carolina, based in North Carolina.
So the plaintiffs told the court, that those are the Democrats, told the court that because of the way the districts have been drawn by the Republican legislature, Democrats cannot win a majority. But attorneys for the legislature, the Republicans, characterized the case as an attempt to get the court to undemocratically change the redistricting process and remove it from the legislature. Attorneys also said it isn't about protecting democracy. It is a full frontal assault on democracy. Those are the opening arguments. So how long will this trial go on?
Well, it could last a couple of weeks, and it's going to get into some excruciating detail. We haven't been covering it every day, but this, like I said, this decision could go differently from the one at the federal level.
It's true that in the last election, didn't Democrats get more votes?
Yes.
Slightly more, but they were not able to break the Republican hold on the legislature.
Before we move on to toll lanes, I want to go back to the president's tweets just for a second, because I forgot to bring up the fact that on Monday night, Charlotte City Council, at the meeting, Council Member Justin Harlow, is planning to ask his colleagues to formally rebuke the president on Monday evening. He voted against the RNC coming here last year, and he says he will be working this weekend to prepare a resolution condemning the president's attacks on U.S. Representative Ilhan Omar and her three colleagues known as the Squad, as well as the crowd's chant at that rally in North Carolina. Julie Eisholt, the mayor pro tem, another yes vote last year on bringing the RNC to town next year, said in a statement that this is exactly what the mayor said on this program on Wednesday, Charlotte is a city that is inclusive, accepting, and welcoming to all people, even to those with whom we disagree. So we'll let you know what happened. You can hear it here on Monday, what happens here at the City Council. The I-77 toll lanes have been open for a couple of weeks, about a month now, and we have a report now on how well they have been received by the public. And that report, David, says what?
Well, they said about 500,000 rides had been taken on the toll lanes in the first month, and that they were having an effect on increasing speeds on the highway. I would point out that it may not be entirely due to the toll lanes, because school is out and people are on vacation, and it may just be that there are fewer cars on the road.
Is the better measure how many people have bought transponders?
It may be, and those numbers are up, although it's a little, I've talked to the DOT about this, and they said they sold another 41,000 during the month. And
is that statewide?
That's statewide. Okay. And remember, there are toll lanes up
elsewhere
in the Raleigh area. And it does look like transponder sales are doing pretty well. I'll tell you, when you come to work in the mornings, there's a fair number of cars in the toll lanes. I drive on 77 most days, and it does look like people are using them, and that what appeared to be a unanimous opposition to the toll lanes in the Lake Norman area, turns out some people are not opposed to using them.
The express buses are not using them yet. Why not?
So I talked to John Lewis, the head of CATS this week, about that. And it comes down to the fact that because there is only 15 miles of the 26 miles open, it would be kind of hard for the buses to navigate in and out of the express lanes at this point. He said they will not be using the express lanes and the northbound lanes until the whole thing is open. He's looking at how they can get them to use them in the southbound lanes. I think ultimately, when they have enough people on toll buses, on commuter buses to go directly from one of those commuter lots into Charlotte, then they will be able to take the toll lane. So, for example, you get on in Huntersville and the bus gets right on and goes straight to Charlotte. That makes sense to get in the toll lanes. But he also said there's issues about training the drivers and getting the transponders. I think it's more about the navigating the toll lanes.
This project is way overdue in terms of it being finished. Are they being fined at all for this?
No. Remember, they extended the terms of the contract.
Okay. Because,
a couple of times
I-77 has been torn up for years now. And even if these toll lanes open, they still have to repave most of I-77, almost to the center city. And I was going to ask you when that might be done. But then it has now been revealed that they're going to, work on the shoulders so that the shoulders along the toll road can be used in morning and afternoon rush hour.
So this was an idea that came out of meetings between local officials in the Lake Norman area and the DOT last year.
Won't that require construction? So as soon as they finish the construction, are they going to start again?
Will require additional construction, and it'll probably be happening, if they get this thing through, it'll probably be happening next year sometime. This would maybe alleviate some traffic. I think there's going to be a legal fight over it, although other folks tell me that this doesn't violate the contract in any way, so we'll have to see what happens.
I have to
there.
Meet with I-77 Mobility Partners. That's the company that's an offshoot of Cintra. That's the Spanish company that owns the lanes
right.
for 50 years, and any impact on their profits from these lanes would have to be run by them. Wouldn't that have an impact?
Well, you would think it would have an impact. I think one of the critical things here is that these would only be used at peak hours, so it's not a permanent full-time facility that would affect it. And apparently some folks believe that that means it's not going to be subject to the contract terms.
So, Danielle, finally, Bank of America broke out the champagne recently because they reported a first half of the year for profits, but they warned that lower interest rates might put a damper on things in the future. Why the profits?
Well, I think it's an interesting story to look at the two big Charlotte banks, Wells Fargo and Bank of America, and kind of the diverging fortunes that they've had over the past couple of years. Bank of America, their CEO, Brian Monahan, has really made sort of cost-cutting measures, although they were up a little this quarter, notably because of their minimum wage increase, mm-hmm. partially because of their minimum wage increase. But they've been seeing these record profits partially because of higher interest rates, which now it looks like the Federal Reserve is going to cut. So, but with Wells Fargo, it's a completely different story right now.
They've reported higher profits, too, but flat
revenue. They did, but they're still, they're in the middle of the CEO search, and they're in the middle of, trying to recover from a series of scandals that started with the sales scandal in 2016.
So I don't know anything about banking, but if you have higher profits and flat revenue, does that mean you're getting the profits because you're laying people off?
Well, I think revenue is a better measure of sort of long-term growth.
Okay.
But it has to do with cutting expenses. One of the measures that Wall Street looks at is the earnings per share. That's the total profit divided by the number of shares. And one of the reasons that Bank of America did so well this quarter is that they actually bought back 7% of their shares over the last 12 months. So that is a little bit of an artificial way to send that number up.
There's a rumor going around that the Bank of America's Chief Operations and Technology Officer, Kathy Bisson, is in the running to be the new CEO of Wells Fargo. Is that true?
Well, it was citing a Bloomberg story that had anonymous sources. So, according to their sourcing, that she is in the running. I know that that's been reported. I believe that's been reported elsewhere. But she's been a top executive of Bank of America. She's very involved in Charlotte and a lot of organizations around the city. So, and, you know, I think hiring a woman has definitely been something that, that they've been talking about and that the people have been hoping to see. So.
It's going to be a very hot weekend through most of the country, particularly in the east and even the northeast, up into 110 degrees in places like New York City and down here in the south. And it's reported this week that it is the southeast that's going to bear the brunt of climate change if we don't do anything about this, that North Carolina has an average of 8 days a year with a heat index over 100. That would go up to 45 by mid-century. That's all the time we have. I'm sorry we wanted to talk about that more, but David Borax, Daniel Shemtov, Mary C. Curtis, and Eric Spanberg, thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.